Not to get all Keynesian on you here, but hey, let's hear it for thinking of things over the long run, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, the 7th of June. Today, good as always to have you along, everybody. We talk often on this program about corporate profits and about quarterly earnings reports and about how companies beat or sometimes miss expectations. Our lead story today is about those expectations. Every 3 months, public companies tell us how much money they made or lost in the immediate past quarter and what shareholders can expect in the 3 months ahead. That forecast, guidance, it's called in the vernacular, has gotten a very high-profile vote of no confidence. Investing heavyweight Warren Buffett and Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase and the head of the Business Roundtable, calling in the Wall Street Journal for an end to quarterly guidance on the grounds that it fosters too much short-term thinking. So, score one for the long term, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
Coming up with earnings guidance is like trying to predict the future, down to the penny, 3 months from now. Useful information if you're investing, possibly with someone else's money.
There's always been a lot of, you know, interest from the analyst community, obviously, to get a sense of which way companies were headed.
Rick Wartzman is with the Drucker Institute. He says once earning projections are out there, companies have a lot of incentive to meet them or beat them.
It's sort of become this game of many companies feeling the need to manage down to the penny so that Wall Street isn't surprised and their stock doesn't take a big hit on the day that earnings are announced.
Wartzman points out lots of executive compensation is tied to that stock price as well, all of which makes for a system that doesn't exactly encourage long-term thinking. Judith Samuelson is with the Aspen Institute's Business and Society Program. She says the focus on short-term results is bad for business.
None of it has to do with the real health of the enterprise. None of it has to do with really motivating companies to invest and to do the things that we hope that they will be doing to create a stronger economy.
And more companies are giving guidance up. This kind of guidance isn't legally required, and research says it doesn't really help stock performance. Sarah Williamson is with a group called FCLT Global, short for Focusing Capital on the Long Term.
It's now a minority, only about 27% of the companies issue quarterly guidance.
And outside the U.S., says Williamson, quarterly guidance is essentially unheard of. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We are going to use that outside the U.S. reference to move on to, or perhaps I ought to say back to, given the news of late, trade. Aluminum and steel have been soaking up so much of the tariff news cycle, it might have slipped your mind that there are 30% tariffs existing on imported solar panel technology. I tell you that because Reuters is reporting that the resulting hit to the American solar industry has already been more than $2.5 billion, which, in that way that consequences have of often being unintended, it outweighs the benefits that American solar manufacturers are getting. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
Not even the Solar Energy Industries Association has a solid handle yet on what their members are experiencing. The association's Dan Witten says the $2.5 billion figure is based on information a few big solar companies have shared.
The real number, I would think, is significantly higher.
He says to expect fuller numbers later this year. There is, however, anecdotal evidence of the tariff impact. For example, one company that doesn't make solar panels, but rather the mounts that attach panels to roofs.
That company, Schletter, made those racking systems and has claimed bankruptcy because of the tariffs.
On the other side of the equation are companies that make solar panels in America. First Solar announced in April it plans to expand production in Ohio. Korean company Hanwha says it'll build a plant in Georgia. But Tim Fox of Clearview Energy Partners says
the ability for the nation to manufacture solar panels has almost doubled. But domestic solar demand for those solar panels has decreased by as much as 20%.
And since that part of the industry is much larger, he expects a short-term net loss of jobs. Longer-term is a different matter. The tariffs are only supposed to last for 4 years.
But what it could do is invigorate a state policy that looks to grow out green energy.
That's because solar tariffs and other Trump administration actions have prompted many greener states, like California, to ramp up their plans for renewable energy. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
We've been spending some time going over the retaliatory tariff schedules that Mexico, Canada, and the European Union have posted in response to President Trump's steel and aluminum duties. There are some commonalities, it turns out, on those lists, besides just steel and aluminum. Orange juice, whiskey, motorboats, and kitchenware are on all three lists, Mexico, Canada, and the European Union. Why?
You want to pick products that are going to inflict as much harm and pain on the other country while minimizing the pain that your own consumers or businesses or workers will experience.
Wendy Cutler is the vice president of the Asia Society Policy Institute, also a former acting deputy U.S. trade representative. The harm and pain thing makes sense, right? But how does orange juice figure?
Well, oranges are one of the classic items.
Renee Bowen is a professor of economics at the University of San Diego. She says, look, you got to think politics.
And of course, oranges are grown in Florida. So any tariffs on oranges will hurt producers in Florida and the South more generally. And that's clearly a very sensitive state for any of the parties.
Motorboats, in case you were wondering, also Florida. This next one you've surely heard, but bear with me here. Wendy Cutler, one more time.
So it's no coincidence, for example, that whiskey bourbon from the state of Kentucky, Mitch McConnell's state, has appeared on many of these lists.
Right. We all knew that. But think supply chain here for me. Would you? Matt Hoffman's a co-founder and master distiller for Westland Distillery up in Seattle, Washington.
It's not just, you know, the distilleries in Kentucky that they think, you know, is mostly affected. It's a huge chain. And now all of a sudden we're up against, in most places, a 25% additional tariff on top of that. So it's hard to say for sure, but, you know, hopefully something can be done about it in the near future.
Hopefully, because as Renee Bowen and pretty much all economists point out,
no one wins a trade war. Everyone loses a trade war.
Among those, though, who have clearly managed to filter out the are we or aren't we in a trade war thing, one may count Wall Street traders and the algorithms that drive them. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Trump administration announced this morning it's made a deal to end sanctions on the Chinese telecommunications manufacturer ZTE. That could go some way to easing the current trade dyspepsia between the two countries, and perhaps just in time, because next Friday, the White House is scheduled to announce details on planned tariffs for $50 billion worth of Chinese goods. The administration is pushing China to buy more American products, as you know, and give American businesses more access to its markets. There has been counter bluster from Beijing on this, but China is also trying to claim credit for reforms it says it's already made to accommodate global trade. Marketplace's China correspondent Jennifer Pack has that one.
On Shanghai's famous waterfront, the Bund, some 300 officials, foreign business leaders, and journalists celebrate the 40th anniversary of what China calls its reform and opening, an economic liberalization plan that opened the state-run economy to the outside world. The reforms have benefited the likes of Fiat Chrysler, says the head of its financing division in China, Brian Williams.
We will be providing funding for more than 130,000 cars this year, helping customers achieve their aspirational dream from the business owner needing a light commercial vehicle to the luxury of a Maserati.
The past four decades of reforms have seen the number of foreign companies in China grow from 900 to 500,000. Firms like General Motors now depend on China for sales growth. On the lawn of the ornate former British consulate, Communist Party Secretary Gao Yun says more opportunities are on the way.
Xi
President Xi Jinping has emphasized that China is committed to opening its markets even wider.
And that's just what American firms have been pushing for. So are China and the U.S. finally on the same page? Not quite, says Xiong Peng, a senior researcher with the Pangol Institution. He says China's reforms may not open all strategic sectors, such as banking and the internet, as the U.S. wants. But the steps China has taken could be just as significant, like its plan to join the World Trade Organization's Government Procurement Agreement, which aims to create a level playing field for all companies competing for state contracts.
Some government departments have avoided buying Microsoft products to support Chinese software. If China joins the agreement, American companies' interests will also be considered.
For now, China says it can't be as open as the U.S. because the country is still developing. Here, amid the jazz, wine, and canapes in Shanghai, it's easy to forget that in many parts of China, something as basic as a flushing toilet is still considered a luxury. To continue to grow, China says it needs to develop emerging sectors like robotics and aviation. American Studies professor Wu Xingbo says U.S. officials are resistant to that.
The attitude of American officials is arrogant. They don't want China to develop its high-tech industries. They'd prefer that we stick to low-value products.
The two countries are now at an impasse. You can find examples of that along Shanghai's waterfront, where importers complain that Chinese officials are holding up some U.S. products from entering the country. This man, who imports a leading brand of American whiskey to China, says he has delayed ordering new shipments because of the uncertainty over whether they'd be allowed in. He doesn't want us to reveal his name for fear of government retaliation. He is hopeful that things will not escalate into a trade war. You've got me, baby, with your pretty face in that ooh-la-la. Back at the celebration marking four decades of China's economic reform, there's little sign of trade tensions as this New York jazz ensemble plays. The government's message to outsiders is that China's open for business, just on its own terms. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Sometimes economic history smacks you in the face not once, but twice. Most recently, it was the financial crisis and the recession that followed. 10 years in this economy that we are covering this year in a project we call Divided Decade. We are doing it, in part, one person at a time with a series of first-person accounts called How We Changed. Before the financial crisis, Stacy Ju and her husband were working for tech companies when the dot-com bubble burst.
We kind of heard from friends, they were saying, oh, there's no future for dot-com anymore. And we know a few friends working on the financial industry, like Wall Street industry, and they were saying that's the bright future, that's the future to go. My husband decided to, he went back to UC Berkeley and he got his master's degree, and then he finally got his job offer from Merrill Lynch. We feel like a bright future lying ahead of us. It went well in the beginning. And then in 2008, I was pregnant with our second child, my daughter. It's pure excitement. And then came the bad news. You read the news and everywhere, and you get the information from like daily talk with my husband, and the outlook is obviously not very good, and everyone was like very depressed. I still remember the day when Merrill was bought by Bank of America. That's when my husband, he was laid off. He got a huge stock options, but overnight, it came to like nothing. It's me who kind of encouraged him to go to Wall Street, and I feel a little guilty. And plus, we just went through the dot-com bubble burst, so a sort of deja vu. We will never jump on the bandwagon with a bunch of crowds anymore. Stability is the number one priority for our family right now. I don't want any sudden change anymore, but I will be prepared.
Stacy Ju and her husband live in Washington, D.C. now with her 12-year-old son and 8-year-old daughter. We've got some pictures of her up on our Instagram. We're at Marketplace APM. And while you're there, tell us how the financial crisis changed you. The hashtag we're using is How We Changed. Coming up.
Putting on a show on Broadway is incredibly expensive.
So what do you suppose has to change to make the economics work, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 95 points today, 0.3%, 25,241. NASDAQ shed 54 points, 0.7%, 76.35. The S&P 500 basically flat, 27.70. McDonald's piped up 4.3% today on news the company is planning a new round of corporate layoffs as part of a major reorganization. Rival Wendy's plumped up 1.4%. J.M. Smucker dropped 5.3% today. The maker of jams, jellies, and Folgers coffee posted fourth quarter profits and sales that fell short of analyst expectations. See, we use that guidance expectations thing all the time. Chipmaker Qualcomm clicked up 1.3% today. The firm makes most of the chips and phones from the Chinese telecommunications giant ZTE, which we were just talking about. You're listening to Marketplace. Mark in Wynwood, Pennsylvania, wrote to tell us how much he appreciates the way Marketplace presents in-depth news and tells offbeat economic stories he doesn't find anyplace else. If you agree with Mark, please join him as a Marketplace investor by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to everybody who contributes to keep public service journalism strong. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are bike share programs in dozens of cities across this country. Rows of branded bikes ready for quick and easy use by everyone and anyone, kind of. There is a growing body of research that finds the advertised universal access really isn't. So from WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris went to find out who is using those bike shares.
The short answer, lots of people are. So much so that I'm here on a busy street outside Pittsburgh's bike share headquarters watching the staff unload a shipment of nearly 200 bikes. Pittsburgh's Healthy Ride bike share program is growing from 50 stations 3 years ago to 175. David White, who runs the program, says that was always the plan, but...
Bike share systems start with a small number of resources.
Many bike shares like this one are nonprofits that fund their programs through grants and corporate sponsorship. To lure more funding, they need to show they're successful. And initial success means putting those bikes in places where they'll get used. That's transit hubs, spots with lots of foot traffic, and touristy areas, which tend to be more affluent. Often overlooked are poor, blighted neighborhoods. This strategy has left bike share programs open to criticism.
The users tend to be young, white, higher income, higher educated.
That's Jennifer Dill, urban planning professor at Portland State University. She's researched these programs in some low-income neighborhoods in New York, Chicago, and Philadelphia, and found only 4% of respondents there were bike share members. She says the systems can be an asset, but...
when they aren't serving the entire community, that's not a good thing.
A big part of the discrepancy... the way bikes are rented. Many of them require apps or credit cards. That means people without smartphones or cards can't use them. And not all neighborhoods are bike friendly. Gabe Klein, who got Capital Bike rolling in Washington, says one reason for that is rooted in the past. During urban renewal in the 60s, highways were largely plunked down in black or brown neighborhoods.
Here we are 50 years later, and we're dealing with the impacts still. And we have these big, wide thoroughfares. Sometimes they're 4, 5, 6 lanes.
And that doesn't lend itself to cycling. But research shows demand is there. Jennifer Dill says nearly 3/4 of low-income residents she surveyed thought bike shares were a good idea. Recently, cities have been trying to make bike shares more accessible. Philadelphia has a cash payment option. Boston offers discounts to people who receive food assistance. In Pittsburgh, bike share director David White closely watched what happened with programs elsewhere. When Healthy Ride was established a few years ago,
it really was kind of a reaction to some of those other cities.
So to get the demographics of riders to match the demographics of Pittsburgh, the cost was set at $2 a half hour, around the cost of a bus ride. There isn't a big sign-up process. No hold on a card and no need for a smartphone. And since October, anyone with a transit card can use a bike for 15 minutes for free.
We wanted to make a model where it felt like an easy way to access just another transportation tool.
So far, about 1,000 more transit users have tried Healthy Ride. While White's staff is unloading bikes from a shipping container, Dino Lombardo and his friend Ross Bucaro walk up. They've heard they can use their transit cards to use the bike share and want to get signed up.
I can still ride the bus too, right?
Yes.
Both men live in subsidized housing and collect disability. Lucaro doesn't have a smartphone and, like his friend Lombardo, doesn't have a credit card. Most months, he says, there isn't any leftover money.
I don't have the money to ride the bike if I didn't have the Connect card, you understand?
But now they can ride. Although for Bucaro, there's another barrier. He hasn't been on a bike in about 40 years. In Pittsburgh, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
The Tony Awards are this coming Sunday, and even before all the hoopla starts, Broadway's got a whole lot to celebrate. It's just had its most successful year ever, more people in theaters than ever before, and ticket grosses of nearly $1.7 billion. Hamilton, Bruce Springsteen's one-man show, also the new Harry Potter play, have theatergoers filling seats. But it is not just high attendance driving Broadway's economic success. High prices for those tickets sure do help, as Ashley Montite reports.
It's matinee day on Broadway. Anna Lee from Central Virginia is standing in line with her family and hundreds of other people waiting to get into the Lyric Theatre. They're about to see Harry Potter and the Cursed Child Part 1.
I've read all the other books and we've been reading them since I was like 6 years old.
I ask her mum, Jill Lee, how much they paid for the tickets.
The only ones available were the max price, $300.
And to be clear, that's $300 per person for Part 1 of the show, and the same price for Part 2, which the Lees are seeing tonight. That's a $2,400 theatre trip for four people.
She has a very expensive birthday. She won't get much for 18, we'll say that.
The trade group the Broadway League surveys theatregoers and says the majority of ticket buyers are like the Lees, tourists from outside the region. Plenty of people are willing to pay top dollar to see the Potter Show and some of Broadway's most successful musicals. The Broadway League says almost 10% of this year's grosses came from Hamilton alone. Fans have paid more than $800 for tickets. Lawrence Maslin is an arts professor at NYU's Tisch School of the Arts. He says the premium ticket is a fairly new addition to Broadway economics.
I think Broadway producers finally cottoned on to the fact that they could offer great seats to a great show when you wanted them. And that was okay to charge extra money for.
It's also a way for producers to claw back some of the money that had been going to resellers who routinely inflate prices. Now producers get to keep that profit for themselves.
Putting on a show on Broadway is incredibly expensive.
Elizabeth Vincentelli is a longtime New York theatre writer and critic.
It's unionized, which I don't mean to say that in a bad way, but it's expensive.
About 30% more expensive than putting on a show in London's West End, according to Charlotte St. Martin of the Broadway League. She says it takes a long time for a hit show to recover its costs.
A show that's doing very well still has to run at least 2 years to not only pay their expenses, but to pay back their investors.
The producers of Harry Potter spent a whopping $68 million just to bring it to Broadway. That includes the cost of renovating the theatre to look like Hogwarts, Harry's fictional boarding school, complete with dark wood panelling and phoenix sconces on the walls. Vincentelli likens the Potter show to a popular amusement park ride. Generations of kids line up to try them out.
They go on for years, and Potter could do that.
And make a lot of money for its producers. Lawrence Maslin says blockbusters like Phantom of the Opera, The Lion King or Wicked, all still running, they've become like the Empire State Building or the Statue of Liberty, part of the New York experience.
For a show to transmute from being a theatrical piece of intellectual property to a cultural lodestar of the most popular city in the world, there's no way to anticipate that kind of gift for the producers behind that.
It's too soon to tell what kind of gift the Harry Potter play will be, but its producers hope it will conjure up attendance and profits far into the future. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of you guys, come on. Facebook announced today that a software glitch might have changed default privacy settings for about 14 million users, meaning things that those 14 million people thought they were posting privately were not private. The good news for the company, I suppose, is that now they've got material for another apology ad. All right, we got to go. Dow up 95 points today, 0.3%. NASDAQ down 54. That's about 0.7%. S&P 500, we're going to call that even. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Steve Gregory, John Gordon, Danielle Irby, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Debke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.